and dine me when I was your girl. Promised if I'd be your wife, you'd show me the world. But all I've seen of this old world is a bed and a doctor bill. I'm tearing down your brooder house, 'cause now I've got the pill.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS 89.5 FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, they're back. One issue that we've talked about several times, and a fellow that we've had on the show, a guest we've had on the show several times. The issue that is back is health care. It's just one of those things that won't go away. We spent a lot of time last year talking about the new health care statute, whether it was constitutional, whether it wasn't. And then, of course, once the Supreme Court decided that it was, why it was, and the reaction to it, it's been fodder for lots of shows and lots of discussions on this show. And you might have been thinking, well, that's the end of that. Oh, no, not by a fur piece, as we like to say here in the hills. There are going to be lots and lots of issues and lots of lawsuits filed over this Health Care Act. And here to tell me about it is a fellow who's been on the show many times, always to great acclaim. His name is Doug McKechnie. He teaches First Amendment law and other forms of law at the Appalachian School of Law, is perennially popular with our students, and does a really great job of explaining one particular issue that you may have heard of. I heard of it last year for the first time when I was invited to be on another show on a podcast that's hosted by the Christian Medical and Dental Association. This particular podcast is called CDD Stat, and I was asked to come on that show and talk about contraception. Specifically, I was asked to talk about whether the new health care statute was going to be interpreted in such a way as to require employers who have health care plans to provide preventive coverage that includes contraceptives. Did you follow me? It basically whether your employer's health insurance program has to cover contraception. Now, some religious organizations, including some of the members of the Christian Medical and Dental Association, object to contraception, and they don't want to be associated with paying for it even indirectly through a health care plan. Some of them object to contraception generally. Some of them object to specific forms of contraception, which they believe amount to abortion. And so there is a range of medical and ethical issues there. But the legal issue is, of course, whether these particular regulations that are being adopted as we speak, pursuant to the new health care statute, whether they are going to exempt religious organizations and to the extent to which they exempt religious organizations. And if the exemption's not big enough, does the statute violate the Constitution? Specifically, does it violate something we call freedom of religion or free exercise of religion? Here's Dr. David Stevens of the Christian Medical and Dental Association.
I think the foundational concern is this extremely narrow definition that was put with this law on what right of conscience is, which is the most restrictive law in federal. It, you know, that you have to be, you know, actually teaching your religious beliefs. You have to have the majority of your employees share your religious beliefs, and the majority of people that you serve must share your religious beliefs, or you don't have any right of conscience protection. You don't have religious freedom, which essentially turns this from being religious freedom to be freedom of worship. You can do what you want inside your church, because that's what that definition is. It's just a church, but it's not a Catholic hospital. It's not a Christian college. It's not anyone else. And of course, on the Protestant side, it's not so much the contraceptive issue. It's the fact that they approved all FDA contraceptives, mm-hmm. and Ella, the newest one, is actually an abortifacient. I mean, it's an analog of RU486. So they call it a contraceptive, but it's not. So here I am actually paying for something that I know scientifically is going to cause an abortion a certain percentage of the time, and now I'm not exempt based on right of conscience. So I think that's the argument that, you know, many of our members have, even those that, and we have a good number of members that think, you know, the Affordable Care Act may be the solution to some of our health care crisis. But they're very concerned about this right of conscience issue. In fact, 95% of our members say they'll quit medicine before they violate their right of conscience.
The list just goes on. And so I'm very pleased that Doug McKechnie is with us today. I'm very pleased that he's going to explain this very complicated area of constitutional and statutory law to us. And without further ado, let's talk to Doug.
It's a pleasure to be here again, Stuart.
Are we going to talk dirty this time?
I'm going to try to avoid it to the extent possible.
Yeah, that's a real pity because, you know, listeners, you've been on how many times? I don't know, half dozen. Yeah. It seems like that anyway. And every time you come on, we talk about dirty language, but I don't think we're going to do that today.
I don't think so.
And we might talk about a couple of things that are a little bit sensitive, and I'll warn listeners that the focus of this is going to be contraception and therefore human reproduction. We might use some terms and talk about some subjects that make some people uncomfortable, but for the most part, it's going to be pretty clinical. And it all comes from this troublesome new statute, not so new statute we have now, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, right?
That's right. Your listeners may remember that in 2010, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act was passed by Congress and signed into law by President Obama. And in 2012, the Supreme Court upheld most of the Affordable Care Act based on the constitutional issues that were raised in that particular case.
Right. And in that case, there were several issues. The big one everyone talked about was whether the so-called individual mandate was constitutional. And as we've discussed on the show repeatedly, it was upheld, the individual mandate, as a tax rather than as an exercise of the commerce power. But nonetheless, regardless of the constitutional basis, the law is good law, and so we're all now in the implementation phase. And so people might be forgiven if they thought, why are we talking about this again? You know, what's going on? Well, the lawsuits have really only begun, haven't they?
That's right. Part of the Affordable Care Act, and I'll call it the Affordable Care Act for the purposes of our discussion, mm-hmm. Part of the Affordable Care Act required that group health plans and health insurers provide what the Act calls preventative measures, preventative medicine, and the Act wanted those preventative measures and treatment to be at no cost to those who were being insured by the insurance companies through their employers. And
that's a very important point, too, just from a policy perspective, because it's almost a given in this area of law and of policy that if you spend money on preventive stuff, in the long run, society as a whole, our country as a whole, will spend a lot less on health care. But the incentives were all, at least that was the thought, that they were all screwed up under the old system. And so preventive care is a huge focus of cost containment under the Affordable Care Act.
That's right. Okay. I think that was Congress's intent, was to try to get ahead of medical issues through preventative treatment. I wouldn't call it a problem, but one issue was that preventative screening and preventative care wasn't necessarily defined in the Affordable Care Act. And so what Congress did was it delegated the authority to determine what kind of preventative care would be covered under the Affordable Care Act. And delegated that authority to a sub-department of the Health and Human Services Agency. And that sub-department was the Health Resources and Services Administration. The Health Resources and Services Administration then delegated further to the Institute of Medicine. And they basically said...
Okay, I'm confused so far, so let me simplify. It's actually pretty common, mm-hmm. even in a big lengthy statute like this, for Congress to come out with a general principle or a general policy and then say to the relevant bureaucracy, and you further define this.
That's correct.
Okay, it's been going on for 100 years, and it's very
common. Absolutely
common. So there's nothing, other than the details, there's nothing unusual about this.
Right, and okay. So basically, the authority was delegated to an administrative agency to determine what preventative treatment should be covered under the Affordable Care Act and what treatment should be provided to those who are insured by insurance companies for health purposes without any cost, direct cost to the insured. And the Institute of Medicine was the ultimate organization that was in charge of determining what preventative treatment should be covered. And what they said was, what the Institute of Medicine said was that all Food and Drug Administration approved contraceptive methods should be provided at no cost. to women. And so that included things like diaphragms, oral contraception pills, emergency contraceptives such as Plan B, intrauterine devices. And those then became the package of preventative services, particularly for women, for contraception, that would be covered by the Affordable Care Act and should be provided to women at no cost.
Now, before we get into the details here, that's where the controversy basically began, and that's perhaps a sort of a starting issue. You've got this bureaucracy saying that contraception is preventive care.
That's correct.
Certainly, contraception properly used prevents something, and that's called pregnancy.
Correct.
On the other hand, we have to acknowledge it's not something that's treating an illness or preventing an illness. It's preventing a medical condition, pregnancy, which can cause problems and certainly simply can cause costs. So that in itself is an interesting question. Is this really preventive care or is this something else? And I'm sure that's what opponents will argue.
Well, what the government found, and this will be perhaps important in our discussion later in the show about what's the government interest. And the government found, as far as the interests that it was trying to kind of capture and further, was that the use of preventative services, including things like contraception, resulted in healthier population. And in a healthier population and reduce healthcare costs across the board. In addition, the government found that access to contraception improves the social and economic status of women. And so that was the government's articulated interest in the Affordable Care Act requiring insurers to provide contraception at no cost.
Okay, so the cost containment stuff is fairly straightforward. Pregnancy does cost money.
Sure.
Unwanted pregnancies cost money, and then they have all sorts of other consequences throughout society. When you start talking about improving the social status of women, again, you might run into someone saying, is that really something we should be doing under a health care act? And I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Sure.
I'm not taking a position on this, but I'm just trying to understand from the get-go why contraception might be controversial. But please continue.
And so when these regulations were published by the government required that those insurers who were going to be required to provide these preventative measures start providing the contraception, start requiring contraception through insurance companies, or if they're self-insured through their own insurance, starting August 1st, 2012. Now, there were some exemptions in the Affordable Care Act that did not impose these requirements on, for example, houses of worship. There is a religious exception, a religious employer's exception to these contraception requirements.
And that's right in the statute. Or is it in the regs?
I think it's in the regs.
Okay, it's in the regs. So when they actually implement these things, we say the regulations have the force and effect of law, so it really doesn't matter where it is. But one way or the other, there's an exception for religious employers, recognizing ahead of time, again, that some employers, I'm just going to pick out the Catholic Church, not picking on Catholics, but who might object to contraception generally, don't have to provide this or don't have to have it as part of their insurance policy, because that's what we're really talking about. We're talking about employer-based insurance policies providing this coverage and, in theory, increasing the costs to the employer. If you add any kind of coverage, in theory, that could increase your costs.
Correct. I guess the argument on the flip side is that when you are increasing preventative measures, you then may ultimately, on the long term, reduce costs.
Right.
So that may be the policy argument in favor of requiring these preventative measures. But nevertheless, there are some exceptions for the requirement that employers provide the contraception. For example, some religious employers who fit into a particular test or a particular kind of a particular group of employers may be exempted, and those are religious employers whose primary purpose is to teach religious values, also who primarily employ persons who share the religious tenets of the organization, also those organizations that then also primarily serve their own kind of congregants and who are nonprofits. And so if you have all four of those factors or kind of elements, if your organization meets those four tests, then you will be exempt from having to provide contraception through your insurance for your employees.
So, for example, a church or a church school that ministers to its own congregation pretty clearly hits all of those. So if I'm the Catholic Church of any town USA and I fit those, then I don't have to provide this coverage.
Well, it's those who object to the requirement believe that the this exception is actually quite narrow. Because if you
I was just going to say that the church probably, I mean, there are
the
lots of institutes that would do it, but then the problem comes you talk about other religious things, and I'll let you go on that.
So if you look at, for example, perhaps a Catholic high school or a Catholic university, their primary purpose may not be to indoctrinate the students, right? That's just part of the purpose. And they may also serve students of other religions. Mm-hmm. They may not primarily only serve people of their own religion, or even a soup kitchen, perhaps, mm-hmm. that's run by a religious organization. And so those who object to the contraception mandate generally, and they often find or argue that this religious employer exception is quite narrow. And so, again, mostly it's houses of worship that are going to be caught up in this exception or will be able to apply for the exception. But other than that, the kind of further afield you get from the strict requirement that you're only serving your own congregants and that you're primary purpose is to indoctrinate or to teach your religious tenets, the further you get away from that, the more likely it is that you will be required to provide contraception through your insurance.
And there are lots of such organizations, lots of them out there. In fact, I was actually interviewed for a podcast by an organization. The podcast was the Christian Doctor's Digest, and that seemed to be the gist of that particular interviewer's concern, was that if you draw the definition of religion or the exemption definition too narrowly, then there are going to be all sorts of people of conscience who are going to be required to provide this against the doctrines of their religious beliefs.
That's right. Now, to the extent that the government was trying to accommodate that issue, the government through regulations did say that religious nonprofits would get a 1-year reprieve from August 1st, 2012 until August 1st, 2013, and the idea was that the government would try to come up with some new regulations that would perhaps capture organizations that didn't fall right within that test and perhaps maybe broaden the test a little bit and provide some different exceptions for religious nonprofits that weren't strictly only houses of worship.
Okay, but apparently that approach, that relatively flexible approach, here's our first regulation, but if you object, we'll try to work with you. That didn't satisfy people.
That's correct.
Okay.
Particularly the people who didn't satisfy and the people who had standing or who had a right to sue because there was going to be an immediate injury were people who owned for-profit corporations and nonprofits that were not necessarily directly religious nonprofits. But particularly at the end of 2012 and very close to the end of 2012, there was a flurry of litigation, particularly with regard to for-profit corporations who were owned by religious people, particularly closely held corporations that were owned by one or two or three or four, a family of individuals.
Can you think of an example? Because it's a little hard for me to get my mind around that.
Sure.
That you'd have lots of people are religious.
Sure.
And lots of people who own corporations. And closely held corporation means it's basically relatively few people mm-hmm. who have it. Who would be somebody that we might be familiar with who falls in that category?
Well, I guess you could say that there's two categories of people that would fall into this kind of more general category, and one subcategory is a group of corporations that the purpose of the corporation, while it's a for-profit corporation, the purpose is to sell items that are religious in nature, right? Perhaps Bibles or statues or things like that.
Okay, good. I understand.
So that's
that.
One group of people. Now, the other group of people is just people who happen to be religious people in their personal lives, but their for-profit corporation has absolutely nothing to do with religious, material that they're selling. So, for example, construction companies, or there was one case. The owner of Domino's is a particularly religious man, and he owns a
Tom Monahan.
That's right.
Right. Yeah, out of Michigan.
He's a pretty devout Catholic, and mm-hmm. he's a big benefactor for Ave Maria
He's basically financed Ave Maria University.
That's right.
Yeah, and law school and everything, yeah.
And he is a strict adherent to the Catholic teachings with regard to contraception. And he owns a for-profit secular corporation, and it's a closely held corporation. He's the only shareholder. And while the corporation that he and the corporation sued the government with regard to the contraception mandate, while it doesn't do anything, it doesn't actually participate in the economy as a religious actor.
It finances a lot of religious spending.
It does
indirectly, one way or the other. And he himself, of course, has these beliefs, and he simply objects that he doesn't want to provide things that violate his religious beliefs.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my buddy, with my colleague at the Appalachian School of Law, Doug McKechnie, and we're talking about the requirement in the new healthcare statute, the regulations that are being adopted pursuant to that statute, regarding contraception and the fact that some people are objecting to having their healthcare plans provide contraceptives to their employees. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more to Doug McKechnie, all about contraceptives, healthcare, and God. Stay tuned.
You gotta use self-control, but if that doesn't work, you gotta use birth control. You gotta use self-control, but that doesn't always work, so you have to use birth control. It's not.
Kelly Carmichael, welcome back to your weekly Constitutional.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
Absolutely. So tell us now, what is the quiz question for this week?
Absolutely. Well, I have a good question for our fans of the law.
Fans of the law, legal type question.
Legal type questions. This is all up your alley, Stuart.
Okay.
All right, the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution permits the national and state governments to take property for public use if the owner is paid just compensation. This governmental power is known as A, eminent domain, B, private domain, C, government domain, or D, public domain.
Well, it's a safe bet that it's called something with the word domain in it.
Domain is it, yes.
Okay, but that won't get us the answer. We're looking for the name, the legal name, the legal concept that's reflected in the fact that the Fifth Amendment says the government can take our property, but it has to do so for a public purpose, and it has to pay us for doing so. All right, let's see what our contestant has to say about that. On the line, we have our contestant, Melanie. Melanie, where are you from?
Venus, Texas.
Venus, Texas. There's got to be a story there.
It's a small town just south of Dallas-Fort Worth area.
And you have no reason why it's named Venus?
Not that I've ever heard.
Is it a place just filled with love?
No, not really. It's just a small farm town.
Oh, I think Venus has something to do with love. I need to look in my Greek mythology. All right. Well, be that as it may, the question, of course, again is, what do we call it when the government takes your property? And let's go through the answer choices one by one. The first choice is A, eminent domain. Do you like that answer?
Yeah, I think that's the best choice.
Oh, really? Already out of the box. Well, hold on. Let's just go through the other ones and make sure you don't like those. How about B, private domain? That's not a good one?
I've actually never heard of that one.
Okay, that sounds like it's made up then. Okay, what about C, government domain?
Government domain to me would be government property that they already own.
Well, good. It seems reasonable. What about D, public domain? I've heard that one before. What about public domain?
I've heard it, but I've never heard it in conjunction with a taking.
Never heard
property.
It. Well, you sound very authoritative. Never heard about it in conjunction with a taking. So you're going to stick with A, eminent domain?
Yes, sir.
Then let's see if you're correct. So, Kelly, what's the answer to this legal type question?
The answer is A, eminent domain.
That is wonderful news, Melanie. Congratulations. You win a T-shirt.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Are you going to wear it with pride?
I most certainly will.
Tremendous. Thank you very much for playing.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with my colleague and my buddy, Doug McKechnie, about healthcare, contraceptives, and God. Specifically, we're talking about whether the contraceptive coverage requirement in the new healthcare statute conflicts with the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. But before we can get to that interesting First Amendment stuff, we've got some preliminary issues to discuss, and one of them involves a subject that may not be familiar to you. It's called standing.
Before you can sue, you have to be able to go into court and say, I have a specific injury that's particular to me that the government's causing me or is about to cause me. And in this case, it's pretty significant, they claim, the pretty significant increases in healthcare costs if they don't provide this. Because there's a penalty associated with this, isn't there?
There is a penalty. It's a pretty steep penalty. I believe it's $100 per day per employee if you do not comply with the mandate that the insurance company provides, or the insurance company for your employees provides.
Wow.
Contraception.
So if I have 10 employees, I'm going to pay $1,000 a day or $365,000 a year.
That's right.
Of course, the ACA doesn't apply to employers with fewer than 50 employees, but that's basically the idea.
That's right.
That's a pretty big stick.
It is a big stick.
Okay.
And the
They're standing.
That's right. Well,
standing's not an issue here, I don't think.
Well, interestingly, I think one of the standing questions is, does the corporation have standing? Does the individual owner have standing?
Right,
because
they're different entities.
Can the corporation exercise religion? And I think that's one of the issues that district courts are grappling with regard
Ooh,
to for-profit
that is so
corporations.
Cool. I dismiss that as clearly having standing. No, there's clearly an injury. But yeah, who is it injuring? Is
that's
it
right.
injuring the corporation? And there's no such thing as a corporation being religious.
Ooh,
that is an interesting standing issue.
A lot of district courts, which is the trial court and the federal level, a lot of district courts have really said this is a case of first impression. Can a corporation, a for-profit corporation, exercise religion? And if it can't, then how could it sue to say that its free exercise was somehow burdened by the government?
Oh, this is actually really cool. I'm so glad I asked about standing. Yeah, what religion is a Domino's Pizza?
Right.
Or the corporation that makes a Domino's Pizza? We know that Tom Monahan is very, very much a Catholic. But, so there's a very interesting preliminary issue here in standing. And so that might ultimately be what gets some of these cases, at least that subcategory of for-profit corporations owned by religious people might get those thrown out.
Well, the courts who have, for example, in the Domino's case, I don't want to call it the Domino's case because, in fact, it's not Domino's Corporation itself. It's another corporation that he owns. So
okay.
I wouldn't want to call it the Domino's case.
Okay.
But that was, I always guess I was doing that.
The pizza case.
The pizza case.
All
if
right.
We should, if we could. The court found that while the corporation does not have standing to sue, that Mr. Monahan could make a claim that his free exercise the free exercise of his religion was being burdened by the government through these mandates. So he was able to have standing in that particular case. So the district court still entertained his claim, but to kind of step back, what he and other plaintiffs are alleging is that even if they are owners of for-profit corporations, they are being forced through their corporation to essentially violate their religious beliefs by providing contraception, or some of them argue that some of the contraception results in abortions, that they're being required to basically fund those types of medical procedures for their employees against their religious teachings.
Okay, two things we've got to discuss very briefly. This is ultimately what we call a free exercise claim, right?
Mm-hmm.
Under the free exercise clause of the First Amendment, which is the very first clause in the First Amendment. It says Congress shall pass, what's after? Okay, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Okay, that's the reestablishment clause.
Mm-hmm.
Or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And it's prohibiting the free exercise thereof that's the constitutional claim that's being made. But you also have to mention something about these contraceptives. Some of them are, like the diaphragm, are clearly just contraceptives. It's a barrier method.
Right. And a lot of Protestant organizations don't have any problem with contraception, that type of contraception.
Sort. The
right.
Catholic Church might.
That's right. The Catholic Church, right.
Other religious groups do not. But a lot more religious groups will object to others, such as the so-called Plan B, or that's, I think it was called RU486 originally.
I believe so. Yeah, there's the morning after pill, and then there's the week after pill.
Right, and those actually can cause a termination of pregnancy after conception.
That's right. My understanding is the egg and the sperm, the sperm fertilizes the egg, and then it's unable to
implant.
Right. And I'm certainly no doctor, but that's my understanding.
Yeah, but there, I mean, each of these methods works by different ways, and some of them are more objectionable to religious groups than others because they see them as abortifacients, I think they call them. It's something that actually causes an abortion, even though everything's on a microscopic level at that point.
Right.
Okay, so there's a variety of religious objections here on the spectrum of contraception, and then ultimately we're talking about free exercise. So please continue.
Well, I think it's important to talk about free exercise because I think that's probably the most interesting, frankly, and probably the main way that this the main kind of lens through which the courts will analyze these cases. But just for the purposes of kind of being thorough, it's not just a free exercise claim that people have been raising. It's also establishment claims, because a part of the preventative treatment is that the employees are can have access to counseling, right? So that's that's the free speech claim. There's a free speech claim that says that you're kind of forcing me to speak through the insurance company. You're allowing these people to be able to access counseling for these kinds of services. And then there's an establishment.
And the counseling might say, go and buy this contraception.
That's right. That's
or use this method, and that's like forcing me to speak.
That's right. So
a free speech claim.
There's also an establishment clause claim, and there's an argument that through the government kind of picking and choosing who's going to get an exemption and who's not, that's establishing a religion.
You know, I was going to actually say that establishment clause is a whole other, and I know we're not going to focus on that today because there's just too much stuff going on here for one show. But the establishment clause claim would basically be that by going and picking and choosing exactly which sorts of organizations are going to qualify as churches and which are not, you're getting far too involved in theological questions. And you're saying this church qualifies, that church doesn't, or this organization does and that one doesn't. And quite honestly, that is troubling. I mean, it is troubling whenever the government interacts with religion at all in a way that seems to give blessing to one, no pun intended, and not to another. So, I mean, there's an issue there, too, and that's mostly the Establishment Clause issue.
Right.
But I understand you want to talk mostly about free exercise today.
Yeah, I do think that the free exercise claim is, frankly, one of the more interesting claims from a historical perspective. And also, I think it's, as I said earlier, I think it's the lens through which the court will really kind of grapple with this issue.
So you think this is the core issue of this case?
I think so. And what's interesting about the free exercise claim is that if you kind of go back historically and look at the free exercise clause and how it's been interpreted over time, it's really kind of, well, it's evolved in one way, but it's kind of ping-ponged back and forth. So if you look back at some of the earliest free exercise cases, say in the kind of 1870s, issues were coming up with polygamy and whether or not polygamy could be practiced. And the Supreme Court at that time in the 1870s said, look, there's a distinction between your right to believe what you want to believe and your ability to actually conduct your religion and the actions that you're able to take through your religion. And the Supreme Court in the late 1800s said, certainly Congress cannot tell you what you can and cannot believe. But the Supreme Court was in no way cultural relativists, and they said, but the Congress is well within its rights to regulate conduct, even if it impinges on your religion.
And those were the Mormon cases.
That's right.
And you know the Mormon Church, of course, at that time believed in polygamy. It was a very important part of their belief system. They'd gone out, been persecuted in New York, been persecuted in Missouri. Finally, went out to Utah, set up the church. They weren't really getting bothered too much out there, but when they decided they wanted to be a state, deals were struck, and well, even before that, there were the statute you mentioned was passed, and that's typically how these cases arise. There'll be some legislature somewhere in a state or on a federal level will pass a statute. Maybe the last thing on its mind is religion, but then some person or some group says, "Wait a second, that law, involving polygamy or that law involving contraception, that impinges upon my right to freely exercise my religion as I see fit. And that's always a problem because you can see immediately that if we allow too many such exceptions, then we're going to have all kinds of problems because everybody who wants to will form his own religion and claim he doesn't want to follow that law. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, such laws can very well significantly burden religious practices, whether they be polygamy or contraception or a host of other things. So those were the first cases, you say, the Mormon cases, where the court wrestled with that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And they came down on the side of too bad, so sad.
I would say so, yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the result of the case and if you look at some of the language from those cases, the court is basically saying, look, if we let everyone run around and say that the government can't stop me from doing what I want to do or can't force me to do something that I otherwise wouldn't do because of my religion, then that would result in every man being a law unto himself, I think, is kind of the quote that is taken away often from that particular
case. It's the Reynolds case, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
That was a big one. Okay, go on.
Yeah. Interestingly, from kind of the 1800s and then jumping forward to about the 1960s, there was a shift, really, in free exercise case law. And in around the 1960s is when the modern, I guess we could call it the modern interpretation or the newer interpretation of the free exercise clause started to evolve. And really what was happening there was the Supreme Court said, we're going to be a lot more protective of one's right to exercise one's religion, and we're not going to let the government just pass whatever laws it wants to if it impinges on someone's exercise of their religion. And so the government at that time, the Supreme Court said the government's not going to be able to pass laws that impose a substantial burden on the practice of religion. And if they do, if these laws do impose a substantial burden on the practice of religion, then the government's got to come up with some compelling interest for the law. You know, what are they trying to accomplish? And is the law narrowly tailored, the most kind of efficient way to accomplish the goal without impinging on too many people's rights?
The least restrictive means. Yeah, that we call that strict scrutiny.
That's right.
So they've gone from the Reynolds case, from the Mormon cases in the late 1800s, where they basically said, too bad, Mormons. We're not going to worry about your religious beliefs. To the middle of the 20th century, they're going exactly the opposite. They've gone 180 degrees.
Yeah, they're much more protective.
Much more protective.
Of the individual's right to exercise his or her religion.
Yeah, and they're going to be much more willing to give what we call religious exemptions.
Yeah.
If someone objects.
And I think maybe what your listeners will find interesting is the change in the law, I think, and who kind of – which justices are ascribing kind of – or kind of buying into which interpretation of the free exercise clause – kind of transcends ideological boundaries or what one might expect from political viewpoints and ideology. So, for example, Justice Brennan and Marshall adopted the much more protective, aggressive interpretation of the free exercise clause and said that we're really going to protect one's ability to exercise his or her religion. And
they were big liberals.
They were.
Big old liberals from the Warren Court era.
And okay. I think some people might be surprised to hear that because some people might think that the more conservative justices would be more interested in protecting religious liberties. But in fact, it was some of the more liberal justices. And that continued to be the interpretation of the free exercise clause for quite a long time until what one may call a paradigm shift or maybe a return to the kind of an original interpretation from the late 1800s. Justice Scalia, in a case called Employment Division versus Smith, wrote an opinion that basically returned the law to what it had been, which was to say that the law was returned to be much more kind of government friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And in Employment Division versus Smith, Justice Scalia wrote a decision that essentially said that otherwise valid and neutral laws that are generally applicable are going to be constitutional even if they impinge on someone's free exercise rights.
And let's pause there because that's very important. So if a law is generally applicable, if it applies to everybody, if it's neutral, that is, it's not directed against a particular religion or religion generally, then by and large, it is going to be upheld.
That's correct.
It's going to be, and even if someone says, wait a second, that hurts my religion, okay. Now, we can't leave Smith without talking about the facts behind Smith, because some people think that's the reason that they went that way. So what were the facts in Smith?
And that may be the case. In Smith, the government action was whether or not someone was basically going to get their unemployment compensation.
Right.
The plaintiff had been fired from his job for ingesting peyote, And
it was a hallucinogenic drug.
It was illegal to ingest peyote, but it was part of his religious ceremony. I think he was a Native American. It was part of his religious experience was to ingest peyote. And
a core part of his religious
that's
experience.
Right.
This was not a pretext. I mean, this was very legitimate. You've got this drug. It's ingested, I think, through smoke, isn't it? You go. I think so.
You can also consume it through eating it.
But it sounds kind of like, I don't know. I mean, it's very, very important. I don't know how one does it. I've never had a vision quest with using peyote. But those are the sorts of things that that has been done for many, many years. So there was no question this was a legitimate religious practice, but it ran afoul of neutral laws that were not directed at any religion. And that applied to everybody, and that is the drug laws.
Drug laws, that's
Controlled
right.
Substances Act.
Right.
Okay.
Right, and so this gentleman got terminated from his employment. Mm-hmm. He applied for unemployment compensation, and typically you get unemployment compensation unless you were fired for cause, for a reason. If it was just a downsize, then you get unemployment compensation. So as long as you're terminated for something that's not for cause, you'll get unemployment compensation. Well, he was refused his unemployment compensation because the government said, look, you did something that was a good – your employer had a good reason to fire you, and so you're not going to get unemployment compensation.
And a particular irony was the job he was fired from, if I recall correctly, he was like a substance abuse counselor.
That's correct.
The ironies just pile on top of each other. But to back up a little bit, basically what people were thinking, many people have suggested that maybe the court essentially was thinking to itself, boy, if we allow the Native Americans to ingest peyote – the next thing we're going to have is the first church of cocaine.
Right.
And the first church of marijuana. And that's going to be, they're going to make it part of their religious ceremonies. And who are we to say it's not?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the drug laws go by the boards because everyone will claim a religious exemption.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, where I'm talking to Doug McKechnie about contraceptives, health care, and God. After the break, we'll have our This Week at Montpelier and a Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and we'll finish our discussion with Doug McKechnie. Stay tuned.
Birth control pills, that's what you need to take.
Eat the jimmies.
Girl, you need birth control pills. Take them each and every day.
Eat the jimmies.
Birth control pills.
When I meet girls out in the bars, I'm not thinking pregnancy, Planned Parenthood tours.
This week at Montpelier, let's head over to the archaeology lab and speak to James, one of our student interns.
I came here with the SUNY Plattsburgh Field School for the archaeology department and was able to stay on for an intern, so I'm staying on until March, working with the archaeology department, helping with the expeditions, and working in the lab, working out in the field.
Great. So what exactly does that mean? I mean, do you go out and dig and get your boots muddy, or do you... I mean, today we're in the lab and you're greeting guests, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's part of your job.
There's a lot that we do. We, as an archaeology intern, I'm working in Arlington House, which is where everyone for the expeditions comes and stays. So the expeditions are where people will come and they'll work for a week.
You say Arlington House.
Arlington House. That is on property... just outside the gates. Where the archaeology excursions will come and stay, and expeditions, will come to stay.
When you say archaeology expeditions, that means when groups of guests will come
groups.
And they want to participate in this. Okay, so that's sort of the starting point for the archaeology activities. Okay.
Exactly. So they'll come and they'll work for a week, and we work with them. When we're not working with them and teaching them what we're doing and how we're doing it, we will then actually just dig out in the field with the other on-staff archaeologists, excavating currently the field quarter. Down in the south of the mansion near the cemetery, and so we're excavating there, and then I'll come in, usually do some photographing for Civil War bullets, do whatever help needs to be needed in the lab, and just generally try to make myself as helpful as possible.
Tremendous. And I see some more guests have come in. Do you mind if I just leave this on?
No, of course.
I'll listen
sure.
to you as you greet them, and then we'll hear what you hear.
Sure.
Your spiel.
All right. Hello, welcome to the archaeology lab. Good, how are you? If you have any questions, feel free to ask me. Unfortunately, our interactive display is down for the week, but feel free to open the drawers over there. They all contain what we found over the course of the archaeology here at Montpelier, which has been going on since about 1985. Feel free to look through them and ask if you have any questions. Mm-hmm.
Did I hear you say they could look through the drawers?
Yes.
I mean, this is hands-on.
Yeah, it's very hands-on. We have all the
the drawers there, which contain study samples of what we found, so ceramics, Native American arrowheads and projectile points, glass, iron finds that we found that have been conserved. We also usually have an interactive display, which really explains what we do in the lab. So say somebody isn't out here power washing or water screening, there's at least an interactive display explaining what we're doing. Usually we'll have all sorts of things going on here because it is such a small space and it is so hands-on. Visitors are able to come in and really see everything that's going on here.
Well, that's cool. I guess I'd be terrified to handle any of these things. I'd pull out a piece of ceramic and immediately drop it or bend something. I hope you've not had anything like that happen.
No, never. No, it's usually, you know, everyone's interested in what they're doing and inquisitive about what's going on. So it's a good way to get.
And I'm guessing the things in the drawers are a relatively durable artifacts.
Yeah, for the most part.
So
yeah.
We don't have any old teapots in there.
Okay. No. If we could find a whole teapot, that would be great.
Okay, and then you would not let us touch it.
Well, I mean, there's the more exciting finds are the cases too that are a little bit behind the wall, but still there for everyone to see. Actually, some very fascinating things. Some whole plates from the Dolly's Midden, which they were excavating a few years ago, and quite a few just fascinating pieces. And we find everything down at the dig every day. Like, we're finding chunks of bone, pieces of ceramic, pieces of glass. We found a nice bone handle for a fork or a knife or a spoon actually 2 days ago, which is really good condition, so that should hopefully be showing up here fairly soon.
The father of the Constitution has been honored in many ways over the past two centuries. Among his many accolades is the naming of a major research university after him. James Madison University was founded in 1908 as a women's college. It was originally called the State Normal and Industrial School for Women. At first, academic offerings included only today's equivalent of technical training or junior college courses. However, authorization to award bachelor's degrees was granted in 1916. The university became the State Teachers College at Harrisonburg in 1924 and continued under that name until 1938, when it was named Madison College in honor of James Madison, the fourth president of the United States, whose Montpelier plantation is located in nearby Orange, Virginia. In 1976, the university's name was changed to its current form, James Madison University. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Doug McKechnie, a professor at the Appalachian School of Law, about the new requirement for contraceptive coverage that's being mandated by the new Health Care Act. And now, Doug's he's not so much a health care kind of guy. He actually is a First Amendment guy. And it turns out there's this provision in the First Amendment called the Free Exercise Clause that's very much at issue in this case, you see, because it's mostly religious organizations that are objecting to the contraceptive coverage requirement. And as Doug is explaining now, the case law in this area started out one way, then it went 180 degrees the other way, and now it seems to have come back again, or maybe it hasn't, because Congress has gotten into the act. This area of the law is very messed up, but we'll do our very best to explain it to you.
So now we have this 180-degree turn back to the way we were during the Mormon cases, and that's the law as of 1990.
It is the law as of 1990. Now, just as kind of a footnote, Justice Scalia in Employment Division versus Smith certainly said, and I think that, you know, this everyone would agree with this, that if a law is focused specifically on prohibiting religious conduct, then that would be unconstitutional.
Yeah, and it's not generally applicable, and it's not neutral.
That's right. So there was an uproar when Employment Division versus Smith came down, particularly from Congress and a lot of religious organizations, because they liked the law before. They liked the protection that the Free Exercise Clause provided and the way it had been interpreted.
A lot of conservative religious people.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
In fact, I think Orrin Hatch was one big proponent of this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And interestingly, Justice Scalia in Employment Division versus Smith talks at length about the fact that, look, the democratic process is where this should kind of be played out. And so that's what people did, was they contacted their senators and their representatives. And soon after Employment Division versus Smith, Congress passed and President Clinton signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which essentially now flipped Employment Division versus Smith. I mean, it couldn't obviously overrule that decision, but it said, okay, we've got the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause, but we want to kind of return to the way the Free Exercise Clause was interpreted, so we're going to pass a law that essentially gives that same protection back to To religious people and how they exercise their
and
religion.
Without going into too much detail, that applies to federal law.
That's correct.
But it does not apply to state laws. And so there really are sort of two different types of the Smith Rule applies to states, and the RFRA, or Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which reinstates the the middle rule, the accommodationist rule, that is governs federal law. And then there's yet another statute out there, and we can just mention it, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act,
right,
which further imposes limitations on certain types of both state and federal law, for, again, very complicated reasons we won't get into. We call that statute RLUIPA.
Right.
Okay, so it's a patchwork.
Right.
It is a patchwork. We really, truly have bonked back and forth like ping pong, like you said, between these two extremes, and now we have a patchwork. And so if you're a religious organization and if you're concerned about a law impinging upon your freedom of free exercise of religion, you have to ask yourself, okay, where's this law come from? Is it state or federal? Mm-hmm. And does it involve land use or does it involve a prison with an institutionalized person? And the rules may be different depending on where the law comes from and who you are and what's going on.
Yeah, and for the plaintiffs who are now bringing these lawsuits with regard to the Affordable Care Act and the contraception mandates, they are hanging their hat on RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, because, as I said earlier, that basically returned the law to what it had been before Employment Division versus Smith came down. And so the government has a pretty high burden, almost the highest burden that we can articulate in the law, particularly from a constitutional law perspective. It's got a high burden when it comes to a high burden to meet when it comes to impinging on someone's exercise of their religion.
So Tom Monahan and the other plaintiffs actually have a good playing field, an advantageous playing field, because now the burden is on the government to pass strict scrutiny to show it as a compelling reason, and it's the least restrictive means of achieving that compelling reason of this regulation. So the government is going to have a pretty high burden to justify these regulations it's come out with.
That's right. First, they are going to have to demonstrate, well, for to kind of get in the door, right? To get to court, the plaintiff is going to have to prove standing, obviously, which is something that we talked about earlier. One other issue that they're going to have to establish for the purposes of their RFRA claim is they're going to have to establish that there was a substantial burden on the exercise of their religion. Now, some district courts who have been writing about this and trying to figure out how to deal with this mandate have said, yeah, of course, no problem. Of course, there's a if the owner of the corporation, for example, a nonprofit, is a particularly devout religious person and objects to the contraception mandate, of course, there's a burden because he or she or they are being required to provide these contraceptions that they disagree with to provide them to their employees. Some courts, however, have said, you know, it's really not, it may be a burden, but it's not a substantial burden. And those courts haven't even gotten to the other two parts of the strict scrutiny test.
Okay, so before we get to this advantageous test, the strict scrutiny test, not only does the plaintiff have to establish standing, like we discussed, but has to also show the substantial burden, and that's what's keeping some of these cases out of the courts.
That's right.
Or at least stopping them pretty quickly. And if I recall correctly, the argument there is that really what's happening, the burden is really on the insurance company rather than the employers. And moreover, some later amendments to the regulations are preventing those insurance companies from charging more when they cover contraceptives. So there's not even a financial burden on many of these employers. Their only nexus to the contraceptive stuff is that they provide a health care plan, which ultimately is going to cover these things.
And that's the argument that some courts have essentially adopted, is that the government has said, look, there may be a burden and that this may make them feel uncomfortable. But the reality is that the employer sends money to the insurance company. And then what the insurance company does and what the employees do and what their health care providers do is so disconnected from that initial payment of insurance premiums from the employer that there's really no substantial burden.
Right.
And that's how some courts have decided that while certainly the belief systems and the beliefs that these employers have and the individual human beings have are legitimate beliefs, there's not a substantial burden. It may be a slight burden, but not a substantial burden.
Interesting. Well, where is the litigation stand? I mean, how many cases are out there? I mean,
there are approximately 40 cases pending right now.
Wow.
And most of them have not. I think none of them have been decided on the merits. Most mm-hmm. of them have been. There have been decisions that have come out around the new year because a lot of plans renew on January 1st, 2013, and so that's when for a lot of plans that's when the mandates kick in. And so there was kind of a flurry at the end of 2012 of preliminary injunction decisions by courts, some granting preliminary injunctions and stopping the contraceptive mandate. Some saying no, denying the preliminary injunction and requiring the mandate to go forward. There was a preliminary injunction request to the Supreme Court by Hobby Lobby.
Hobby Lobby? That must be one of those for-profit corporations.
It's a for-profit corporation.
Owned by a religious
person. It is. And Justice Sotomayor denied the preliminary injunction request.
Preliminary injunction. Well, what's happening is you've got 40 cases. They're all over the United States. And, of course, it'll be a long time before there's any definitive ruling, if ever, from the Supreme mm-hmm. Court. It doesn't necessarily ever get that far. But before we start getting some more or less final decisions out of the circuit courts of appeal, it'll take some time. And some of the first thing that's going to happen is a lot of these plaintiffs are going to be asking for preliminary injunctions. And essentially, they go to the judge and they say, look, here's the law, judge. We're going to win.
Right.
And if the judge agrees that there's a good likelihood that they're going to win
and
that they're going to be damaged.
That's right.
Okay, they're suffering immediate damage. Then the judge can, in his discretion or her discretion, offer preliminary injunction. And that's what we've been seeing.
Right.
That's what we've been seeing is whether or not these are going to be granted.
That's right. And again, as I mentioned, there was a flurry of them kind of near the end of 2012 because for a lot of plans, January 1, 2013 is when the mandate would kick in for plans. And just so your listeners know, lawyers do actually sometimes work hard. There were some decisions that came out on December 30th, which was a Sunday.
Wow.
And I noticed when reading some of the cases that there were briefs filed and lawyers working on December 25th, 2012. So
good heavens.
Lawyers are working hard to try to figure this out.
Well, this year the lawyers were being grinchy then, if making them work on Christmas. Okay, well, obviously we've got more time before this is all going to be sorted out, maybe in another year or two before it makes its way all the way to the high court. Any predictions? What do you think this one's going to come out? Look into your crystal ball. Doug is reflecting very deeply.
I am.
Now.
I think this is a really difficult. I will tell you this. I will say this will be my prediction. That if the Supreme Court finds that there is a substantial burden, if the Supreme Court finds that the shareholders of for-profit corporations have standing, mm-hmm. right? Because I don't think the corporation's going to have standing.
Right.
But if the shareholders have standing, and so that if they can challenge the law, and if the burden is found to be substantial, the Supreme Court says that the burden is substantial, then they're going to win. Because I'm not sure that the government is going to be able to succeed in their argument that this is the most narrowly tailored way to accomplish what may very well be a compelling interest. I'm not sure that the government's going to be able to.
Right. If we ever get to strict scrutiny, the government almost always loses.
That's right.
And they probably would here, too. And that's the ultimate issue, you know, the free exercise issue. But there are two very big hurdles the plaintiffs have to get over, that standing and that substantial burden. And so, okay, that's about as much as I think that's probably a pretty good prediction.
Yeah, because the Supreme Court or courts often will try to come up with some other way they could have accomplished the goal. And if someone can come up with some other legitimate way that they could have accomplished these goals, these interests that the government has, they're probably going to lose.
That's why strict scrutiny is so hard to make. But anyway, we'll be watching this with great interest as it unfolds over the next couple of years. And Doug McKechnie of the Appalachian School of Law, thanks so much for talking to us. And we didn't use one bad word. Not one the whole time.
Next time, Stuart.
Next time. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks.
This old maternity dress I've got is going in the garbage. The clothes I'm wearing from now on won't pick up so much yardage. Mini skirts, hot pants, and a few little fancy frills. Yeah, I'm making it for all those years since I've got the pill.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to Doug McKechnie of the Appalachian School of Law, who told us all about contraceptives, health care, and God. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
Oh, Daddy, don't you worry, Nana, 'cause Mama's got the pill. Oh, Daddy, don't you worry, Nana, 'cause Mama's got the pill.